Let's take our Bibles and turn to Matthew chapter number 8. Matthew chapter 8, we're going to read starting in verse 23. Excuse me, down to verse number 27. Just a few verses here this morning. Matthew chapter 8, starting in verse 23. Matthew, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, wrote this: "And when he was entered into a ship, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great tempest in the sea, insomuch that the ship was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. And his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we perish. And he saith unto them, Why are you fearful, O ye of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. But the men marveled, saying, What manner of man is this, that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Little five-year-old Johnny, I don't know why every illustration is Johnny, but this is little five-year-old Johnny, and he was in the kitchen as his mother was making supper. And his mother looked at him and asked him to go into the pantry and get a can of tomato soup for the supper, but he protested and said he didn't want to go in alone. "It's dark in there, and I'm scared," he said. "I don't like going in the pantry by myself." Well, she asked again, and finally he persisted. And finally she said, "Okay, Johnny, remember this. When you go into the pantry and it's dark and you're scared, remember this, that Jesus is in there with you." Well, Johnny said, "Okay." And he walked hesitantly to the door of the pantry and slowly opened it. And as he opened it, he noticed that it was very dark and very scary in there. And he almost started to leave when an idea came to him. And he said this: "Jesus, if you're in there, can you pass me the can of tomato soup?" We may not be afraid of the dark or the pantry or the hallway closets, but there are certainly things in our life that we fear, that we are afraid of. I think that's why the Bible tells us over and over again, fear not. Don't be afraid. Don't fear. Because our tendency is to default to fear. And we are afraid of so many different things. And that's exactly what we find in our passage here this morning. The disciples who had faithfully followed Jesus, they had heard his teaching, they had seen his miracles, they'd understand it to a small extent his power and authority. And yet, here they are in the middle of the night, caught up in a storm, totally fearful for their lives, totally afraid. You know, I was thinking this as I was studying this week, that how it's interesting how many accounts there are in the Bible where we see God at work in the lives of different people through a storm at sea. You ever think about that? I think of Jonah, right? Running from God, running in the opposite direction, boarding a boat heading in the opposite direction of Nineveh. And God brought such a storm down on the boat that these experienced sailors were fearful for their lives, crying out to their gods. And finally, they understood that it was Jonah and his disobedience, and they threw Jonah overboard. And as soon as they did, God brought an end to that storm. And they sacrificed to the Lord, and their lives were changed. And Jonah's life was changed. And the people of Nineveh, their lives were changed, all because of a storm at sea. I think of Paul in the book of Acts on his way to Rome as a prisoner, and how God used that storm at sea, that shipwreck, excuse me, to get the attention of those people, the centurion, the guards, the people on the island of Malta. God used the storm at sea to accomplish that. God often, and here in our passage and other similar ones, God often used a storm at sea. And I think there is good reason for that. Many of you have experienced or know someone who has experienced being out on the sea in a storm. You know what it's like to be, there's nothing more out of our control than being on a storm in the sea, being thrown about by the waves and the wind. There's no feeling more helpless than being in a boat that's being tossed back and forth by the waves in a storm. And I think it's a good picture, it's a good illustration of being in a place physically or spiritually or emotionally where we feel absolutely helpless. Like there is nothing we can do to help ourselves. There's nothing we can do in this situation but cry out to God and ask Him to save us. And that's exactly where the disciples are in Matthew chapter 8, verse 23. They're following Jesus into a boat, and yet they have no idea what's about to come. And what I'd like to do this morning is just take this passage, maybe a little differently than we've done so far, but just take this passage one verse at a time and learn some truths, some principles, some applications as we move through this account. I want you to see a number of things this morning. First of all, I want you to notice that following Christ doesn't guarantee a storm-free life. Following Christ doesn't guarantee, it doesn't promise us a storm-free life. It says in verse 23, and when he was entered into a ship, his disciples, what? Followed him. If you remember just last week, we looked at the account of two different men that were challenged to count the cost and follow Christ. One of them came to Jesus and said, Jesus, I'll follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said, wait a minute, I need you to count the cost. The other man, Jesus looked at him and said, follow me. And he said, but I have some things that I need to do first. And both of them counted the cost and were confronted with counting the cost of following Christ, and they both found it to be too steep, too high, too much to follow Christ. And they refused, as far as we know. And yet, did you notice the word there in verse 23? He entered into the ship, and his disciples followed him. They, in contrast to the last two men, these disciples, probably speaking to a small number of the 12, at least four have already been mentioned by name. These disciples follow. They counted the cost and they decided that it would be worth it to follow Christ, that they would go after him. The word follow there is the same word that Matthew uses elsewhere in his gospel as disciple. Discipleship. They found that it was good to follow Christ, to be a disciple of Christ. They were obedient followers. They counted the cost and they accepted it. They said, we'll follow you wherever you go. And they went with Jesus. And we commend them for their obedience. But notice in verse 24, behold, there arose a great tempest in the sea, insomuch that the ship was covered with the waves. What was the cost for following Christ? Well, in this instance, the cost was, Matthew tells us, that there was a great tempest in the sea. The word that Matthew uses there for tempest is the Greek word seismos, which you might understand, we get our English word seismic from. So when there's a great earthquake, we call it a what? A seismic event. It's a massive event. That's the idea of this word. It was not just a little storm, but this storm was a seismic event. It was massive. A great tempest. One commentator said this of the Sea of Galilee, and you can see it there. There's the mountains all around that. The Sea of Galilee was surrounded by these mountain ranges, some of them as high as 2,600 feet from sea level, from above the lake. And especially infamous was the east wind that would blow over these mountains, especially in the spring and in the fall. The lake's low-lying setting resulted in sudden, violent downdrafts and storms that would produce waves 7 feet or more, easily able to swamp one of these little fishing boats. And this was one of those storms. And this storm had come so suddenly, so severely, that it took these disciples off guard. These experienced fishermen who had spent their entire lives on the sea were so overwhelmed and so afraid of this storm that they thought they were going to die. Matthew tells us that the ship was covered with the waves. I remember in high school, one of my sisters, Rachel, when she was in high school, shortly after me, was part of a kayaking club. She used to race kayaks. And every week she would go to either Fletcher Lake in Fall River or Lake Bonook in Dartmouth, and she would practice, and she would kayak, and she would go out first thing in the morning, and she would spend time training or racing or doing all those things. And I remember her coming home one day, and it was a particularly windy morning. She had gone on the lake before sunrise, and a bad wind had blown in, and she said that the waves had gotten so high on that lake as she was practicing that she couldn't see the shore in any direction, that she felt like she was totally lost, didn't know where to go, because the waves were crashing over the boat. And what a terrifying, what a helpless feeling that was. And that's exactly where the disciples are. The waves are crashing over the boat. And Mark tells us in his account that the boat was full. Full of what? Full of water. That's never a good thing when a boat's full of water. And they're terrified for their lives. They're afraid. Now, I say all that to say this. I think this is one of the most remarkable things about this storm, that it came when they were following Jesus. Jesus said, "Follow me." And they did. They obeyed him. They did exactly what he called them to do. And now they're about to lose their lives, at least so they thought, for doing the right thing. The storm comes anyways. I was thinking this way by way of application, that we should never think that just because we're following Jesus that we ought to be exempt from the storms of life. Could Jesus have prevented the storm? Of course he could have. But he didn't. The disciples were following him. They were being obedient to him. And they followed him right into what might have been perhaps the biggest storm of their lives. Those men who had decided not to follow Jesus, they were at home on dry land. They weren't stuck in the storm. But these disciples followed Jesus right into one. They were about to see Jesus exercise his authority over nature itself. They were about to learn a lesson in faith that they would have never learned had they not followed Jesus into that boat. Sometimes following Jesus means that we are going to face storms. Divers temptations, James calls them. Various trials. God, and we can face them this morning with the knowledge that God is going to use them to teach us something, to reveal something about himself to us. But we will face these storms. Just because we follow Christ doesn't mean we're exempt from storms. But I want you to notice, secondly, that whether we see it or not, God is present in those storms. I love the last words of verse 24. "Behold, there arose a great tempest in the sea, insomuch that the ship was covered with the waves." But, what does it say? He was asleep. In fact, you don't see this in the English, but in the original Greek, Matthew says it like this. He says, "But he was asleep." He was asleep. The disciples are panicking. They're terrified for their lives. But here's Jesus in his boat full of water, and he's asleep. He's sleeping away. And I think that really speaks to two things. Number one, I think it speaks to the fact that he was tired. He had just finished the day preaching and healing and spent a majority of the night healing diseases, casting out demons. Jesus had just physically given of himself so much, and he was exhausted. And I think it reminds us of the humanity of Jesus Christ, that here he is, he's worked all day, he's exhausted, that even in the middle of a storm, he's sleeping on the boat. But I think it also speaks to this fact that he wasn't panicked like the disciples were. He wasn't afraid of the circumstances. He was completely at peace in the middle of the storm. Why? Because he knew that the storm was under his control at all times. He knew that he was in his Father's will, and he had no reason to be afraid, so he fell asleep in the boat in the storm. And the truth is this, as long as Jesus was in the boat, the disciples didn't have any reason to fear either. It may have seemed to them like Jesus was unaware or uncaring, that he didn't know what was going on, or he didn't care about what was going on. But neither of those were true. He had peace because he was in full control the whole time. And friends, sometimes when we face a storm in our life, we're tempted to be afraid. It seems like God is either asleep or he's unaware of what we're facing. Maybe he's not interested. We have to remind ourselves this, that God doesn't sleep or slumber. We have to remind ourselves that God is not on vacation. He's not too preoccupied. That God is there. He is present. He's aware. He's in control. And as long as Jesus is with you in the boat, in the storm, you have nothing to fear. Nothing to be afraid of. Jesus was present in the storm. I want you to notice thirdly this. And often the best thing we can do in a storm is call out to Jesus. Look at this in verse 25. His disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, "Lord, save us. We perish." You know, I can see in my mind the disciples in this boat. The waves are crashing in. And they've got buckets and they're bailing out the boat. They're bailing out the water, and for every bucket of water that they throw out of the boat, 10 more come in. And they're trying to work against the storm and work against the waves, and they're trying. The boat is filling fast. Their attempt to save themselves have failed miserably. It's a futile effort. They're trying to bail the water. They're getting nowhere. And so at this point, they finally come to Jesus, and they cry out three words in the Greek, "Lord, save us, we perish." Lord, save us, we perish. In a Mark's account, they come to Jesus and they say, "Lord, don't you care that we're perishing? Don't you care about our situation?" And I was thinking this, what do you think they were asking Jesus to do? I don't think they knew what they were asking Jesus to do. Jesus later rebukes their faith, so I don't think they were asking Jesus to calm the storm, because when he does calm the storm, they're totally blown away by it. They're amazed. It was beyond what they could ever imagine Jesus could do. So I don't think they were asking Jesus to calm the storm. I think maybe they were asking Jesus to help them bail. Get a boat, get a bucket, and help us get some water. Maybe they were asking Jesus to take control of the situation somehow, in some way. Maybe they're saying, "Lord, I don't know what, but do something about this storm." The point is this, after a lot of self-effort, they did something that they should have done from the very beginning. They went to Jesus and said, "Lord, save us. We perish." I think that request, shows us exactly how we need to come to Jesus. There's three ways that we need to come to Jesus. First of all, they recognized who Jesus was. They said, "Lord, Master, Teacher." In one word, they confessed his deity and his authority and his power. they recognized finally, after all their self-attempts, after the futility of trying to bail out the boat, they recognized finally that there was only one person that could do anything about the storm that they were in. And they came to him and said, Lord. Then they said, save. Save us. I think that there, secondly, was an admittance of their need, that they needed something that they couldn't do themselves. They had no hope. They had tried every effort, every possibility. They had tried, and yet there was nothing they could do. And so they needed to be rescued. They needed deliverance. They needed something that they were incapable of doing themselves. Lord, save us. And then they said, we perish. They rightly stated their situation and how utterly helpless they were. Unless Jesus intervened, unless Jesus helped them, they would be lost. They would perish. By the way, that's exactly how we need to come to Jesus. Lord, save us. We perish. I think there's a good explanation of how a sinner ought to come for salvation. Lord, save me. I perish. Listen, you cannot be saved. You cannot be rescued. You cannot be delivered from your sin, from death and hell, unless you, like the disciples, realize your need and your hopeless situation without Christ, and recognize who Jesus is and say, Lord, save me. I need you to do it because I can't. Rescue me. By the way, that's exactly how we need to come to Jesus. Lord, I need you. When you're facing a storm in your life, the best thing that you can do is to cry out to the Lord in the same way. Lord, save us. Lord, help me. It's not about self-effort. It's not about bailing the water out of the boat yourself. It's not about some great long prayer that needs to be said. The disciples came and said three words. Lord, save us. We perish. Lord, help me. Deliver me. I need you to do it because I can't. We read earlier as we started the time together this morning in Psalm 50 in verse 15, it says, God says, call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver thee and thou shalt glorify me. Call unto me and I will answer thee and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not. Call unto me. They came to Jesus. They recognized their need. They called on him. They cried out to him. But then notice this. I find this so interesting. Before Jesus rebukes the storm, he first stops and rebukes their lack of faith. In verse 26, they come to him. They wake him up. They say, Lord, save us. We're perishing. Lord, help us. And Jesus, woken up out of sleep, gets up and he looks and he saith unto them in verse 26, why are ye fearful, O ye of little faith? And I want you to notice that the word that Jesus uses here for fearful is not the word you might think. It's not the word phobos, which we often have translated as fear or afraid. But instead, Jesus uses the word delos, which has the idea of being timid or cowardly and afraid. And I think that's significant because the word he uses here for fear is not just fear, but he's talking about sinful fear. Fear that is not correct. And you might be thinking to yourself, wait a minute, the boat was full of water. The boat was sinking. They thought they were going to die. It could sink at any minute. Of course they would be afraid, and so would you, and so would I, if we were in that situation. But Jesus goes on to say, he says you're fearful because you have such little faith. And the thought is this, They had no reason to fear because Jesus was in the boat, but they forgot that. They had just listened to his teaching. They had just seen him do miracles that were beyond their capability to totally understand. They saw what he was able to do. Didn't they not know who was in the boat with them? You know, Jesus had just commended the centurion for his great faith. Faith that he said was unlike anything he had seen in Israel. And yet here, he's disappointed in the disciples because of their lack of faith. They knew who he was. They saw his authority and his power, and yet they didn't catch on the implications of that. They didn't trust him when they were in their own storm. They saw what he could do in somebody else's life. They saw what he had done in the past, but they, as they were in the storm, couldn't trust him in the present. Now listen, the truth is this. I don't want to make light of the situation that you go through. Whatever storm you may go through, it's not easy. It's difficult. The storms we face are very real, sometimes very terrible, very difficult. But the point that Jesus is making is this: haven't you seen God work before? Don't you understand who God is and what God can do? Don't you think that God knows exactly what you are facing right now in your life? Does he not see you? Is he not the same God of David and Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego? As God said to Moses, is the Lord's hand waxed short that he cannot save? Can God not deliver you and rescue you from the situation that you find yourself in? Has he not done it before and again and over and over and over again? And I think the truth is this. Sometimes God needs to rebuke our faith before he rebukes the storm. Sometimes God has to say to us, why are you so fearful? Why are you so afraid? How is it that you have no faith? Haven't I told you, be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God, and the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, will be yours? Haven't you seen enough of my power and my love to know that you are perfectly safe with me in the storm that you find yourself in? Listen, when we are aware of the power of God and the presence of God and his love in our life, we realize that there is absolutely nothing to fear. And before God calms the storm, he needs to rebuke their faith. Don't you know who I am? But then I want you to notice, fifthly, Jesus can calm the storm. He could do it with a word. He says, why are you fearful, O ye of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. Jesus turns and he talks to the wind and the water. Anybody else, you might think that's crazy. But Jesus has authority like nobody else does. Mark tells us he rebukes the wind. He scolds the wind. And he speaks to the sea. He says, peace, be still. He literally talks to the storm, and it goes in a moment from being a great tempest to a great calm. Great still. It didn't happen over a moment of hours. It happened immediately. You know, it's amazing. In St. Lucia, we would often go out after a hurricane would come through. We kind of hunker down for the hurricane as it comes through. We'd go out before and see the wind starting to whip up the sea and the big waves. We'd let the hurricane go through, and then we'd go back out to the beach again. And for some days after, the waves were just massive. It was neat to go out and see them, and just the power of the hurricane, the power of the storm and the waves. After all of that, it would be beautiful out, but the sea would still be all whipped up and still massive waves. And it would take time for those waves to calm down, but not in this storm. Jesus rebukes the wind. He says, "Peace be still," to the waves. And immediately it went from a great tempest to an absolute calm. Jesus totally stilled the storm with his word, showing he had complete authority, not just over sickness, not just over demon possession, but even nature itself obeyed his voice. And I love how the disciples respond. They say, "What manner of man is this? Who is this that even the winds and the waves obey his voice?" They were blown away. Of course they were. You would be too. And the truth is this: whatever it is you're facing in your life, whatever storm you are in, whatever great tempest you may face, listen, God can take it in a moment from a seismic tempest to a great calm in just one word. God can calm the storm. Jesus spoke, and I love the word picture there. It literally means this, that Jesus muzzled the waves like a dog wearing a muzzle. That's what he did. He spoke to the waves, and they were absolutely calm. They were completely under his authority. Jesus spoke, and with his word, proved himself to be sovereign over all creation. Even creation, even nature itself listens to his voice. And if God is sovereign over all creation and over all nature, is he not sovereign over your life as well? Can he not calm the storm with a word? I suggest this morning that he can. If he can calm the seas, he can calm your storm. But I want you to notice, sixthly, finally, when Jesus calms the storm, it should result in our worship. Excuse me, in verse 27 it says, "But the men marveled." I think that's an understatement. They were amazed, saying, "What manner of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Matthew tells us that when the disciples saw it, they marveled, that they were amazed. Mark tells us in his gospel, as they saw that they feared exceedingly. Luke tells us that they saw it and they were afraid. And it's not the same word that he used for fear earlier, delos. When Luke says they were afraid, that's the word phobos. That they saw the power and the authority of Jesus Christ, and they were afraid. They had what it can be translated as a deep, heartfelt reverence. The disciples just got a glimpse of who was in the boat with them, and their cowardliness had been replaced now with reverent fear of who God is and who Jesus was. When we trust Jesus to take us through the storms of life, he takes us through to the other side, and he shows us more of who he is. And as a result, if we truly learn what he's trying to teach us in the storm, I think we'll come away more in love with him and more in awe with him and more surrendered to him, because we'll have a glimpse, we'll have an idea even more of who he is and what he can do. Yeah, I think worship occurs when we really see God for how great he is and respond to what we see in an appropriate, heartfelt way. And the truth is this, I think many of you can attest to this in your own life. We certainly can, I certainly can. It's often as we go through the hardest storms of life that we really see Jesus for who he is. Sometimes it's in those most difficult situations that we really get a glimpse of the power and the authority and the work of God in our life. We understand just a little bit more, and we're in awe of him. Isn't that true throughout the whole Bible? I think of people like Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, and cast into the fiery furnace for refusing to bow down and worship an idol. They saw and they understood and they felt the presence of God, but it wasn't until they were in the fiery furnace that they felt it. Or Daniel in the lion's den. Or Stephen, as he was being stoned, and you look up and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing on the right hand of God, and he understood something about God that he hadn't before. He saw something in that storm. I think it's often when we are in the fire, when we are in the storm, that we really understand who Jesus is. And our fear is turned to faith. It's turned to godly reverence and worship. We stand in awe of who God is and what he's done. Let me encourage you this morning to choose faith over fear. To understand that, yes, we may go through storms. We will go through storms. This life is not just a bed of ease, but as we do, we are not alone. Christ is there with us. We can cry out to him and he can calm the storm, or he can give us the grace to endure the storm that we're in. But either way, he's with us, and we choose to believe him for who he is and worship him for who he is. Let me finish with this quote I read this week from Dr. E. Stanley Jones. I thought it went right along with our message, and I'll finish with this. But he said this: I am inwardly fashioned for faith, not fear. Fear is not my native land. Faith is. I am so made that worry and anxiety are sand in the machinery of life. Faith is the oil. I live better by faith and confidence than by fear and doubt and anxiety. In anxiety and worry, my being is grasping for breath. These are not native air. But in faith and confidence, I breathe freely. These are my native air. He said, a Johns Hopkins University doctor says, we do not know why it is that worriers die sooner than non-worriers, but that is a fact. He said, but I, who am simple of mind, think I know. We are inwardly constructed in nerve and tissue, brain, cell, and soul for faith, not for fear. God made us that way. To live by worry is to live against reality. He said, you are made for faith, not fear. Choose faith over fear. Jesus rebuked the disciples, why are you fearful? Oh, ye of little faith. And maybe he needs to rebuke us that way this morning. Why are you fearful? Oh, you of little faith. Don't you know who I am? Don't you know what I can do in your storm and in your life? Let me encourage you this morning to trust him, to choose faith over fear.